Okay. I just don't want to keep her waiting.
Yeah, no, it's fine. So put the computer where you're going to have it, and then put this in front of your mouth.
Is that better? Is that better?
The more, like, direct... So this is the front of the mic.
Okay.
So, like, you're going to need that basically, like, in front of your mouth.
Okay.
Like that, and then it'll sound really good.
All right, and now it's... All right. Okay. All right.
And then you should be good. And then when you're done, let me know, and I'll tell you how to deal with that. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Once in a while, jiggle this so it doesn't go to sleep.
All right.
All right, good luck.
Thank you. Yep. Hello? 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 Hello, Professor, can you hear me? Hello? 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 I don't know if she's hearing me. Hello, Professor, can you hear me? Hello? Hello, Professor, can you hear me? Hello? 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 I don't think she's hearing me.
Sure. So that's a your computer thing.
Okay.
So let's go to settings. We'll do audio. That looks good, and it's getting sound from you. So that's good. Turn this up. Yeah, it's getting sound, echo cancellation.
It's getting sound from us?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where
she's are you recording it, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Just checking. That looks good. I guess...
Can you try
to test? Yeah, I mean, it's getting signal. Mm-hmm. So.
Hello, Professor, can you hear me?
You might have to add them to... Have you ever used this program before?
I haven't. Okay.
Let's try that.
Hello, Professor. Can you hear me? Hello, Professor. Can you hear me?
Why don't you try adding yourself to the stage, too?
Okay. Hello, Professor. Can you hear me?
Hello. I can hear you.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. Okay. So again... sorry, I'm in one of the podcast rooms on campus, and it's been, some technical glitches, but I'm sorry about
that. No worries. And remind me, how did this podcast come to be? I wasn't even familiar with the fact that there are podcast rooms on campus that students can use. Yeah, just give me a little bit of the background for this.
All right, so I'm a student you know, in one of the classes at Penn, so I'm a grad student, social policy and data analytics, and we, you know, have this data for equitable justice lab class, and, you know, so we needed to, one of the requirements of the class is to work on a project, right? And, you know, so I'm originally from Liberia, so it's a West African country, went through 14 years of civil crisis and blah, 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 blah. And so I've been deeply passionate about philanthropy. I was, you know, at home, like, doing the Ebola crisis and, you know, led some major initiatives and blah, 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 blah. So I've seen firsthand the tremendous impact of philanthropy, but, you know, so going through just your website, the Center for High Impact Philanthropy, saying, you know, it gives me a different perspective about just philanthropy. So most times it's like someone writes a check or, you know, you give, you know, someone volunteered your services. So, you know, I was just very interested in speaking with you, you know, learning from you. You know, you have an impeccable profile. So hopefully learning from you. And yeah, so the goal then is to embark on this as a personal project, right? And get a team around it. So on YouTube, I've seen a lot of people go around interviewing people around, oh, you're wealthy, you know, how did you make your money and things like that. So the long-term goal is, how about we start asking people, you know, the best of humanity, you know, really asking people about, you know, you've done so much for philanthropy, what inspires you, you know, future generations, especially with everything going on right now.
And so this is actually your class project is doing the podcast series. And then is the idea that you would submit it as a class project, but then sort of have it available. And is it just the podcast? So it's just audio, or are you doing a video along with it?
So I'm doing both.
Okay.
Yep. So the inspiration is from a class project, but I hope to continue to do it long term. I have, you know, I've been reaching out to a few other people to serve as my next guest. But
Excellent. And then are you graduating in May? Are you finished the program already?
No.
Okay. All right. So you'll still be around. All right. Excellent.
I'm staying here for another year. And also I just got elected as vice president for the graduate and PhD student government. So I have a long year.
Wonderful. Congratulations.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Just let me know when you're ready so we can get started.
Okay. Great. And just again, what you're a grad student in SP2 now?
Yes.
Okay. And in the MSSP or MSW or NPL?
So there's the MSSP plus DA program.
Okay. Oh, I got it. Right, because you mentioned data analytics.
Yes.
Excellent. Okay.
Yes.
Very good.
Yes.
Great.
All right.
So I'm ready whenever you are.
Okay. Just give me 1 second here. All right. Welcome to Philanthropy for Life podcast, where we dive into the world of giving, generosity, and the drive to make a real difference in our world. I am your host, Mo Samaro. Every episode, we bring you conversations with thought leaders, change makers, and visionaries who are shaping what it means to give back. Our today we have the pleasure of speaking with Professor Katharina Ruskwede, a pioneer in strategic philanthropy whose work has not just broken the mold, but reshaped it entirely. So to get started, you know, Professor Ruskwede, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name's Kat Ruskwede, Katharina Ruskwede. Mo, you can call me Kat throughout this podcast. And I am the founding executive director of the Center for High Impact Philanthropy. For those of folks who are not familiar with the center, our mission is to serve as an independent source of knowledge and education on how philanthropy can do more good. And I came to the University of Pennsylvania and Penn School of Social Policy and Practice now almost 17 years ago to launch the center.
Yep. Thank you so much. So what really prompted you to take on this challenge, and what has your journey been like? Is there a personal inspiration? Where does your motivation come from for this?
Yeah, well, I guess I'll start with the professional journey that led me to launch the center, and then happy to talk about how my sort of personal experiences and interest also led me on that particular personal professional journey. So I was recruited and appointed by the late Rich Gelis to launch the Center for High Impact Philanthropy. And he recruited me from McKinsey & Company, which is where I had been after I got my MBA from Wharton. So like the founders and the initial funders of the Center for High Impact Philanthropy, I'm a Wharton alum. Wharton is the oldest collegiate business school in the world. But the Center for High Impact Philanthropy was always housed here at the School of Social Policy and Practice, which is one of the oldest schools of social work in the country, the United States, and one of only two in the Ivy League. And I always mention that because I think it's important to know about our center that we take a deeply multidisciplinary approach to our work. And it was founded by a business school and a school of social work. Right, social worker meets financier. And in many ways, that pretty unusual combination reflects my own career. So before McKinsey and before I came to get my MBA, I had worked for 10 years in and with nonprofits in the social sector. I was early on with Wells Fargo's Community Development Group. So I was employed by a bank. But the community development group included the foundation, included the employee volunteerism program, included Community Reinvestment Act compliance. So one way to think of it is all the community-facing activities of the bank were in the group that I was in. From there, I launched a nonprofit program that called Board Match Plus, which recruited and strengthened nonprofit boards of directors with a particular focus on individuals who were often not tapped to serve on nonprofit boards, but whose perspectives could be incredibly important in making sure nonprofits were able to achieve their mission. So we focus especially on younger individuals and individuals from communities of color. And then after that, I was, helped the team that launched what became New Schools Venture Fund, which is one of the first venture philanthropy funds in the U.S., founded by venture capitalists like John Doerr and Brooke Byers and an incredible social sector leader named Kim Smith. And that particular venture philanthropy group focused on improving access to education, particularly K-12 students in the U.S. So as you can see, my professional experience spans the for-profit and the nonprofit sector. And though many people associate me or see my resume and see McKinsey and think of my business training, more of my experience was actually working in and with nonprofits.
Well, it seems you've had a very extensive and broad experience, you know, across different sectors, and, you know, deeply proud of the work you continue to do wherever you've worked and wherever you've gone. I'm just curious. So on the website of the Center for High Impact Philanthropy, there's the High Impact Giving Toolkit and High Impact Philanthropy Academy. Can you tell us a little bit about both of them?
Yeah, of course. So, you know how I said earlier on that the center's mission is to provide knowledge and education on how philanthropy can do more good? Yep. The toolkit and the academy, the two things that you mentioned, really are the way we do that. So I'll start with the toolkit, and that is knowledge for the field. And we started producing that several years ago, maybe 8 or 9 years ago. It's available for free for anyone from our website and through partners like the Giving Compass and Fidelity Charitable. And it's really meant to be a public resource for anyone who's trying to understand how they can practice high impact philanthropy. And that's because one of the things that I have found, which is a myth in my opinion, was that people often thought, oh, you have to have a lot of money to practice high impact philanthropy. High impact philanthropy is only for the millionaires or the billionaires. And my response to that is always, if you only focus on how much money somebody is giving philanthropically, well, then you really only focus on the input, right? That's kind of high input philanthropy. Yep. High impact philanthropy is about how well you use the resources you have in order to do good. And if you understand it that way, then literally anybody can practice high impact philanthropy. And the toolkit was meant to support anyone who has some resources, whether it's $5 or millions of dollars, who wants to understand how can they make a bigger difference with that. So that's what the toolkit is. And it includes things like the different ways philanthropy can help, sort of frameworks for deciding how and where to give. It includes what we call exemplars. So these are nonprofits drawn from our partners that can illustrate just how impactful philanthropy can be. And then it also includes a lot of different resources in the field. So philanthropy, just like any other sector, continues to evolve. It's really dynamic. And, you know, there are more and more resources out there to help donors and professional grant makers understand the issues they care about, identify nonprofits that are working well to address those issues. So that's the kind of content that is in the toolkit. And like I said, it's part of our commitment to making our knowledge available to anyone who wants to make a bigger difference. Now, the Academy is for a particular segment of folks. And so I can talk a little bit more about that if that's helpful.
Yeah, please go ahead. Please go ahead. Yeah.
So what we discovered was that there were individuals who knew of our mission and had accessed the toolkit and wanted more support in practicing high impact philanthropy. These were often individual high net worth donors who had a lot of resources to give, or professional grant makers, right? Their full-time job was to make grants and gifts to nonprofits. Sometimes they were from public agencies who had, whose job was to make grants. Yep. To nonprofits, but not from a foundation, but from a public agency focused on, say, education or arts and culture. I mean, and there were always people from corporate philanthropy. So high impact philanthropy is not for any one kind of grant maker or funder. It's really for anybody who is at a point in their personal or professional journey and they want to have more impact. And they want to understand what that means, and they are eager to learn. And so they come to, it's now a hybrid after COVID, it's a hybrid program. So you first, they all come to the University of Pennsylvania's campus. It is a cohort-based program. So in May, we'll have 27 people from across the country and around the world. Okay. Will come to Penn's campus. As a cohort, they'll learn some of the foundational principles of practicing high impact philanthropy. Okay. Equally or more importantly, they will meet each other. And I always emphasize that is probably one of the most important resources for any philanthropic practice is that community of practice. Yep. That you learn from and helps you get better and better.
Yep.
Right? Just like almost anything in life. Yep. And then it continues online where they take some of the principles that they learned while they're on campus and over a course of several weeks.
Yep.
Through real world case studies and interaction with their fellow peers, their cohort mates.
Yep.
Practice applying that.
Okay.
And then for those who are interested, they can take the high impact philanthropy exam and earn a certificate. Okay. Which is a nice signal, especially if they happen to be professionals.
Yep.
That there is a sort of a body of knowledge and experience that they've gained in practicing high impact philanthropy. So that's what the Academy is about. It's a way for us to fulfill our education mission.
Okay.
Alongside the knowledge mission that the toolkit represents.
Okay. And, you know, regarding the Philanthropy Academy, how do you go about selecting philanthropic leaders? Is it through application? Is it, you know, what do they have to do in order to be eligible for, you know, to participate in the academy?
Yeah, so we, and I, you know, shout out to the Center for High Impact Philanthropy's team. So, you know, that includes folks like Kelly Andrews, who oversees that program, Ariel Sensor, who's on Kelly's team, Iris Leon. We work really hard to make sure there is a strong cohort. So everybody who is in that cohort has already had experience making grants, right? This is not a 101 type program. And so that's one, is that they need to have had substantive experience. Otherwise, part of what we'll teach will either, they won't be able to apply it in the same way as their peers. And because I would say they learn as much from each other as from the faculty, you know, you sort of get as much as you can give. And if you don't have some body of experience to give, it'll be hard for you to be able to appreciate what your peers are offering, and you won't be able to help your peers as much as you could. So there's a baseline level of experience that is required. And I'd say some of the other things we look for are, you know, are they at a point where they are eager to learn and share? So this is not a good program for somebody who is not willing to share their experiences with others, who is not open to being candid, both about failures and successes, right? So there's a certain kind of person or profile that is drawn to this. But beyond that, there's a huge diversity of people who apply. And some people may decide that they're not quite ready for it, so they'll apply again later. We also find that some of the people who get the most out of it are people who come with somebody else that they work with. So if it's a family foundation, we often have like parent-child combinations, or sometimes we'll have two people from the same staffed foundation or agency. So sometimes people will feel ready, but they know that they will be able to implement things faster if they come almost with a running buddy. So those are some of the things. But we try to create a cohort that has sufficient diversity across the members of that cohort, that there's a really rich learning environment. Because one of the things that we leave them with is, it's not just what we teach and the case studies and the discussions and the materials that they get on their Canvas site. It's really that community that helps them long, you know, years after they've gone through the academy. We hear from alums about how much they are continuing to learn and work with their cohort mates.
I mean, thank you so much for some of the things you're doing at the center to address, you know, all these concerns. You know, I know most times, you know, the philanthropic sector, you know, really there's not enough support, right, in terms of getting leaders ready for just the challenge ahead, or changing trends, or, you know, all of these different issues. So really my concern is, what are some of the most pressing challenges you see in the sector today, and how do you think they can be addressed? And I know you're addressing those through the toolkit, you're addressing some through the academy. Are there any other you can think of, and how have you seen other people address them?
So, I mean, some of these challenges are evergreen, right? If you think about the role of philanthropy, philanthropy is trying to address the problems that persist, even with prior philanthropic help, with the efforts of government, with, you know, what the role business is playing, right? So these are the tough problems. And so there's this evergreen challenge of needing to address society's toughest challenges with the least financial resources. So if you if you compare philanthropy to the amount of money that governments have available, or the amount of money that the business sector has available, it's a drop in the ocean what philanthropy has available. So, I mean, that is just a structural and ongoing challenge, is that philanthropy, I think at its best, is charged with addressing society's toughest issues, but has the least amount of financial resources compared to all the other sectors. And that's why we have to be so thoughtful and strategic about how philanthropy is used. I think there are some current challenges that philanthropy has. One is that in the United States, where we're talking, and around the world, there is a increasing wealth disparity. And so that means that if you think of philanthropy as wealth to serve the public good, there's a growing divide or gap between those who have the wealth to help and those who are lacking resources and opportunity. And that can make it challenging. You know, that means there's just like blind spots that those with power and money have to figure out, like, well, how can we deploy? They don't have this. They don't have shared experiences, right? With so that's one. There are all sorts of biases, and often when you've got that kind of disparity, it also means it's hard to there aren't the same mechanisms to learn and understand and appreciate different realities, right? It's sort of like the realities of those two groups is just farther apart because of the wealth disparity. I think another is, on the one hand, we have access to more and more information than we've ever had. And there are technological tools that could help us do more good. But more information doesn't necessarily mean more insight or wiser decisions. So I think that's an ongoing challenge, is how do we use the sheer volume of data and information well?
Okay.
And how can we use technology? What are the harms that technology could produce?
Yep.
How do we mitigate those? And how do we learn quickly how new technology can help us do more good? Right, those are challenges that are kind of, they've always been there, but I feel like it's more of this moment.
Okay. Yeah, my next question was going to be around AI and just, you know, everything good or bad. Do you think, you know, just the rapid technological change, artificial intelligence, we've seen ChatGPT, mm-hmm. we've seen a host of other new technologies.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, you know, just the fourth industrial revolution would position the sector to do more good, or do you see it as posing some sort of harm?
I mean, I think that's sort of the million-dollar question, right? And I think that's the opportunity is there, right? So technology and data, in and of themselves, they're not, you know, agents for harm and good. It's how do we use them? How do we deploy them? And are we providing equitable access to them? And I think that's what we need to focus on, is, you know, because philanthropy and the nonprofit sector in general has fewer financial resources and less, they are not necessarily, there's no like obvious entity to hold them account for using their resources to do good. That means that we've got to figure out, how do we not let things like AI and increasing access to data simply reinforce existing disparities? And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I'm so proud of the education and work that we're doing here at the School of Social Policy and Practice. I mean, we were one of the first schools to identify the need for education and training around data analysis for social policy. Right. And, you know, that's a way in which our school and our university can help ensure that tools like AI and other technological advances is to train the next generation of leaders who will make sure we are looking at these developments and understanding what is the impact of this on social policy, social practice, social justice, social innovation, right? That's sort of we need more people thinking about that to ensure that we mitigate the harms and take advantage of whatever benefits there are to do more good.
I mean, as a student in the program, I've seen firsthand just how good the program is at just training students to ask the critical questions about, you know, it's this, you know, this result, this project, this data you're showing me, is it biased, right? Can we be doing more, right? So, yeah, I know firsthand. And if you play a part in designing the program, if you didn't, if you support it in any way, thank you so much. So I know firsthand, you know, what's happening. And again, I've interacted with a lot of my friends, a lot of colleagues, students who are also deeply passionate about data, social policy. So how can aspiring philanthropists effectively measure and understand the impact of their contributions? Or what advice would you just have for young people today looking to, you know, pursue philanthropic endeavors or just, you know, get a job in the sector?
So I'll start with your first question around what can philanthropists do to measure and understand the impact of their efforts? I mean, I think it always starts with having clarity on two things. What is the intended purpose of it? So there's a lot of good in the world that philanthropists can do. And unlike something like profit, where there's one unit that you can measure profit in, right? There's one monetary unit. In the US, it would be dollars, right? So every business can measure itself on how much profit in dollars is it returning to its owners. When you get to the social sector, education outcomes are, that's different from personal safety, which is different from maternal mortality, which is different from environmental sustainability. So if what you're trying to do is understand, are my gifts and grants making a difference? You really have to have clarity around, well, what's the difference that you hope it will make? That's number one. And then I think the second consideration is to know that there are lots of different ways that philanthropy affects change. And philanthropists always affect change through the organizations and people philanthropy funds. So you have to right-size your expectations around measurement to what you're actually funding and the developmental stage of the effort, right? You can't expect the same outcomes for a well-established nonprofit with professional staff that has been around for 30 years. To a pilot, a grassroots pilot program that is starting with a very committed group of volunteers. So that's the other principle that I would give, is that impact measurement and measuring and managing for results will always be challenging, and you will never have the same confidence that you can have with something that is relatively simple, like what's the profit of a business that you've invested in. So, you know, what I would say, what you're looking for is, do we have a sense? What is giving us a sense that we are headed in the right direction? Right? That's not going to boil down to a number, and you cannot have the same level of confidence just because we're talking about real world issues that are affecting real people in a dynamic world. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't monitor and manage, because that's what's going to help you course correct if you made a mistake. It's also what's going to help you make sure you're not doing harm. Right. So just because you can't measure with confidence and accuracy does not mean you should give up. It just means you should be realistic and honest with yourself. But it starts first with having clarity around what's the good in the world this is meant to create.
Okay.
And what are some of the things that I can look for that will help me know that we're on that track? And how do I make sure that I'm matching my expectations to the kind of thing I'm funding and the developmental stage of the organization or groups that I'm supporting?
Okay. And the last question was around any advice for for young people looking or, you know, work in a sector, pursue philanthropic endeavors and.
Yeah. Well, so the nonprofit philanthropic sector, first of all, it's incredibly diverse, right? It includes everything from, you know, the University of Pennsylvania, which is a nonprofit, or the hospital system, right? To an all-volunteer grassroots soup kitchen, right? And everything in between. So when people are interested in a professional career in the nonprofit sector, know that it is multiple sectors, really. And because it's so diverse and because it has relatively fewer resources, it's also incredibly fragmented, which means that it's not like if you want to be a lawyer or a doctor or an investment banker or go into sort of product management, for example. Even government, to some respects, where there's a well-known track to leadership opportunity, there's a ladder. It's not the same in the nonprofit and social sector. So especially for people who are starting out, who are relatively early in their career, my two pieces of advice are this. One, it's going to be about the people you meet and work with who mentor you. The people. I mean, that's probably true of every career, but particularly in a sector that is as fragmented as the nonprofit and philanthropic sector. And that's why particularly early on and with your first jobs, I would say choose your boss more than the brand of the nonprofit organization or even the function. It's your boss early on because it's opportunities come via your network. Is what's going to matter more than anything. And because there isn't as much formal training for many of the roles, that person will not only be the person to connect you to further opportunities, but that's where your best first training is going to come from. So number one, choose your boss well.
Okay.
And then the second is keep your network active. Except for McKinsey, nobody had any of the jobs that I had before me. And the reason I found those opportunities is because people around me who cared about me and knew my interests, and I kept them apprised of the kinds of things that I was looking for, right? And then they helped me find opportunities, sometimes even before there was a job posted. And so those are the two things. Early on in your career, choose your boss and keep your networks active and engaged, because that's where, in a fragmented sector, so many of your opportunities are going to come.
Oh, no, I thank you for that advice, and I absolutely agree. So I'm taking an elective class in the School of Education, and, we just had a whole week talking about social capital and what it looks like and how you should be a social capital, you know, and everything.
Yeah.
But, the next session is really talking about you and your legacy. But I just wanted to ask you one final question before we go to that section.
Sure.
So from your perspective, what constitutes high impact philanthropy? You know, because there are all these different wars out there. So I've seen, strategic corporate philanthropy. So sort of like a buzzword, so strategic corporate philanthropy. You know, I was reading a lot about it, high impact philanthropy. You know, is there a difference between the two? And why is it vital for, just sustainable social change or, sustainable progress in the philanthropy sector and just addressing, all these pressing challenges in general?
So just like any sector, the philanthropy sector has all sorts of jargon,
Yep.
All sorts of labels for activities that sometimes are actually pretty similar.
Yep.
And I've never walked into a room where people said, oh, you know what? I really want to practice low impact philanthropy.
Yep.
So high impact philanthropy means different things to different people. It's almost always considered, of course, if I have a choice between high and low impact, don't I want high impact? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give you the Center for High Impact Philanthropy's definition
mm-hmm.
of high impact philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And I'll just say not everybody uses this definition, but it's the one that we use and that drives all our work.
Okay.
So first of all, high impact philanthropy is the use of philanthropy to create positive social change. It mm-hmm. starts with a focus on social impact. That's what I mean, positive social change, serving the public good, right? I'm going to use those terms interchangeably.
Okay.
The reason that's important is because philanthropy plays a lot of different roles in individuals' lives okay. and in society overall.
Yep.
This is what many people would say the most noble purpose of philanthropy, which is to make the world a better place.
Yep.
That is the starting point yep. in our definition yep. for high impact philanthropy.
Yep.
There are three other principles in our definition of high impact philanthropy. Starts with a focus on social impact, serving the public good.
Okay.
The second principle is decisions are informed by the best available evidence. Broadly defined. We're not talking about just looking at the results of a randomized controlled trial study, although if there's relevant evidence there, absolutely use it. But it's about looking at information from what we describe as three sources of evidence.
Okay.
When there's relevant academic research, absolutely use it. When there are perspectives from stakeholders, informed opinion, that can be very valuable.
Okay.
And a source of evidence that is too often overlooked are the experiences and priorities and observations of the communities most directly affected and the nonprofits who are serving them.
Yep.
When you practice high impact philanthropy and you find information or evidence from all three circles yep. of evidence pointing in the same direction, that's when you can get really excited. That's when you can say, this feels like a better bet than maybe some of the other options.
Yep.
So focus on social impact informed by the best available evidence. And frankly, that's because a lot of things that philanthropy is focused on now, these are evergreen issues. Poverty, intergenerational poverty has existed
yep.
before. These are not new things. And so what you want to do, you don't want to waste any money
yep.
reinventing the wheel
yep.
or making the same mistake somebody else has paid for. That's why you want your decisions informed by the best available evidence.
Yep. No, thank
the
you.
I'm
sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. So I'll quickly lay out the two and then I can sort of talk more what we mean by them. The third one is, no surprise,
okay.
linking considerations of impact and cost. And that's just okay. because no one of us has enough money to make the kind of change we want to see in the world.
Yep.
So it's our responsibility to yep. make sure that we are using whatever money we control as well as we can.
Yep. Right?
And then the fourth principle is, like I said earlier, this is not something, you can't change the world overnight, right?
Yep.
And the world keeps changing too. So you have to have a posture of lifelong learning,
yep.
right? You have to be able to measure and manage and monitor, not for compliance reasons, because that's the only way you're gonna be able to learn.
Yep.
Learn when you have some successes and share it with other people so they don't have to pay for that learning.
Yep.
And also learn where you might be headed to doing some harm and you can stop it before yep. that happens.
Yep.
So those are the four principles. It starts with a focus on social impact, informed by the best available evidence, linking considerations of impact and cost, and having a posture of continuous learning
yep.
to improve.
Yep.
High impact philanthropy for us at the center is a practice that incorporates all four of those principles.
Yep. Oh no, just and I think you did a wonderful job of just breaking down, you know, something really complex, right? So it touches on every piece of, you know, what's out there and just how we should approach this. And I know there, you know, so there's also been some critiques around just for a lot of corporations, right? It's really around tax time. You know, we've seen them giving so much money to, you know, philanthropic causes just because of, you know, as a tax avoidance scheme. So really, I have this much money to pay. What would be your message to, you know, just corporations in general that are sort of engaging, you know, philanthropy as more so, let me avoid paying tax to the government, because if I give it to a nonprofit, that means I could count it against you. It's not a revenue, so I can't, you know, I can't pay tax against it. What would be your advice in terms of how do they sort of be proactive, right, in engaging with nonprofits and in, you know, in being very deliberately in their approach to, you know, creating social impact?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say there's two things. It's not just corporations who use philanthropy for the tax benefit. Remember, 70% of philanthropy, of money that goes to public charities, is not coming from corporations. Actually, corporations are pretty small. It's coming from individuals. Okay. And there are many individuals who are incentivized, maybe not primarily, but incentivized by the tax benefit they get. Yep. So I would say the dynamic that you're highlighting is not at all specific to corporations. Okay. I think corporations, though, unlike individual donors or unlike foundations, where they have control, right? An individual can decide where they go. And foundations, you know, they are given their tax exempt status because of their charitable purpose, right? Yep. You have to endow that foundation with a charitable purpose to even get the tax, you know, the tax protection. Corporations, though, don't operate in the same way. They do not exist for charitable purposes. Yep. And they have owners, whether it's a private company that owns it, you know, private owners, or it's a publicly traded company, in which case they have shareholders. So they actually don't have, corporations can only focus on using philanthropy to serve the public good if their owners are on board with that choice.
Okay.
They can't just do it. That is one of the reasons why there have been developments in the field like B corporations, benefit corporations, because there people realize that unless a corporation knows that its owners, whether it's a privately owned or a shareholder, wants to see decisions made that align with a mission or public good, then, like, they can't, the leaders of those companies can't just do it. But if you're a B Corp, baked into your corporate governance can be some language about how you are using the corporation's resources. And that can bring some alignment between philanthropic efforts and corporate resources.
You know, so that brings us to the last segment of our, you know, of our episode, you know, and it's really around just understanding, it's this segment is really about you, right? And you have,
I'm more comfortable talking about the Center for High Tech
Philanthropy. I guess one of the goals of the podcast is, it's also hear you talk about your work, but also get to know you as a person and how envisage your legacy, right? So I'm sorry if that makes you uncomfortable. So it's really reflecting on your contributions. What do you hope to be most remembered for in the field of philanthropy?
In the field of philanthropy. Um, I hope I'm remembered for having worked to unlock more of good. Right? This is what motivated me to launch the Center for High Impact Philanthropy is that even before I came to Penn to launch it, I've been an individual donor, giving donations. $50 here. I'd served on nonprofit boards. I was the beneficiary of philanthropy, right? I wouldn't have been able to go to the schools that I went to were it not for scholarships. And I was a, in grant-making institutions. So part of what motivated me to launch the Center for High Impact Philanthropy is that having been an individual donor with institutional grant makers, the recipient of philanthropy, served on nonprofit boards, I recognized that there's a lot of untapped potential still for philanthropy to do more good and for people who have resources to get off the sidelines, right? Why do people who have a lot of resources and good intent stay on the sidelines? Because they are not as confident about knowing that this is going to make a big difference. And if my efforts and the team at the Center for High Impact Philanthropy help unlock more of that potential, that would be a legacy that I'd be very, very proud of.
And this is the next question, right? If you were to write your own obituary today, what philanthropic achievements would you highlight? And how, what outside of just philanthropy in general, what are there any other things you want to highlight?
I mean, I sort of feel like the best legacy a person can have, not just like in the field of philanthropy, is I left the world a better place. And that's I think that is a good life. And that includes, not just what I do professionally, but a better place because of the mother I've been, the sister I've been, the daughter I've been, the friend and neighbor I've been, right? We make the world a better place, not just because of what we do professionally, but because of the relationship, the quality of the relationships we've made. Because it's relationships that build the people's capacity. And unlock individuals' potential. I was talking earlier about the potential of philanthropy, but really, it's unlocking the potential of people is really, I think, the best legacy any of us can claim.
And that's very inspiring, coming from someone who's, lived through some of the harshest conditions imaginable, who lived through, the Ebola crisis, who lived through like in a country for after 14 years of civil conflict, seeing a complete collapse of infrastructure. There's this push to want to do better, to just look around you and to impact people's lives. So having you want to be remembered for that, means a whole lot. And just one final question, right? It's, you know, you, so just going through your profile, I just had this really big image. I was intimidated at one point, right? Just you've achieved you've achieved so much, including, right, being named one of the philanthropists, philanthropy 100, a list of people, organization and companies making a positive difference in the world. So not only are not only have you done really incredible things, you're actually one of the 100 most important people in the field, right? But what do you say to that? What inspires you to keep doing what you're doing?
I mean, hopefully like there's a part of me that's like, don't believe all the press, right? Because I know how I am grateful and honored by, first of all, what you're saying and some of the ways that my work and the work of our center has been recognized. I mean, you know, I sort of feel like I do this work for a reason, and that reason often stems from my own personal experiences and and the values that my family and the people around me have shared. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it goes back to your, you know, the other question that you asked, which is sort of, what do you want your legacy to be? I mean, for me, I have had a lot of privilege. Right, like a lot of privilege in terms of health, in terms of the country I was born into, in terms of the educational opportunities, which, as I said, philanthropy helped me access. And you know, because of that and the values instilled by my family, that those privileges need to be used for a bigger purpose. And I, you know, because of the people that I've worked with and that I have found a place to do that here at Penn to strengthen the role that philanthropy can play in making a better world. So, you know, I think some of why we choose to do what we do is a little bit of a, like, happenstance, kind of who we're exposed to when. But I'm motivated because the work that I do now is very much aligned with the values that I was taught and the kind of legacy that I want to have, which is around, you know, I think if all of us can aspire to leaving the world a better place when we move on, I mean, just think about like what the future can hold.
You know, it's been an absolute pleasure, and your insights have been extremely profound and enlightening, but also very inspiring, very, very inspiring. It's, you know, sometimes you are one of the, you know, one of the best of humanity, right? Because most times we don't understand how, you know, how much it takes, you know, to contribute so much money to a cause that's not bringing you profit. Right, or to volunteer your service or to dedicate your life to making other people's lives better and just, you know, helping humanity in general. So thank you so much for joining us. And if you have any parting comments, anything to say, you know, please go ahead.
Well, I mean, first of all, Mo, you have been an incredibly gracious host of this podcast and moderator. So thanks right back to you. And I was just delighted to be able to have a conversation with you today.
Thank you so, so much. It means a whole lot for you finding the time to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for what you're doing.
Yep. And have a good weekend. Thanks a whole lot again. It means a whole lot.
All right. Take care, Mo.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
All right, see you. I just wanted to ask, so were you recording the whole time?
So can you log back in? Yes, it should be recording. It looks like it just...
Okay.
But you have... Well, anyway.
It's this right here. Which password is it, my computer password?
It's your pen key.
My pen key?
So same one you used when.
Yeah. It's a long password. Is your, sorry, is it cap lock working? This one right? I just want to make sure.
Okay. Let's see what this. Press it.
Yeah. Okay.
So now,
okay.
Now
yeah, I see you now.
Okay. Yeah, now it's on.
All right. Okay. All right. Okay.
Great. Okay.